to Syria and understand what the enemy wants for Lebanon, which is an entity under direct Israeli control and destruction of Lebanon. Your thoughts, what can the Lebanese, what should the Lebanese learn from Syria?
No, absolutely. I think that's well said, that they're going to occupy a piece of Lebanon. Let's not beat around the bush about it. That's exactly the plan. That is Eretz Israel. That is working towards Eretz Israel. And that's something that's been very clear from the Israeli agenda. So Lebanese people, look at their country for the last time with those borders, because that southern part of that border, Israel is going to take. And then once they eat that, they're going to eat the rest, and it's going to be a continuous process, which has been going on since 70 years, ever since this Zionist project has been allowed to flourish in this area. Now, that's exactly what's happening in Syria, where they've taken over this land, and they're not going to give it back. This idea, and they're using this idea of one minority playing it against another minority. And this is the strategy that Israel's been used. Over there, they've supported the Christian minorities or the Druze communities, where in actuality, those Druze were the very first people to be part of the rebels. So it's kind of just using one party to another and to get their ends to meet. And Lebanese people need to realize that, you know, you have to come together. This is the defense and sovereignty of your nation. And what's really sad is that, what I think is very, a point that, you know, my colleague mentioned, Batul, is about the resistance. Let's be clear here. Hezbollah goes away today. Hamas goes away today. The resistance is not going to end. Because the issues behind why the resistance exists, those inequities will still exist, and people will raise their banner to resist against the Israeli Zionist project. Okay. And that's something that that people need to realize, that that's not going to happen. And just one last point before you continue is that what we see out of Europe, when we talk about you regionally, look what they're doing to Russia. I mean, they unilaterally just froze all the assets of the Russians just last week, right? And the ceasefire hasn't even occurred. So, I mean, when we talk about tools that are available for these very countries who talk about, oh, we support Palestine, we recognize Palestine, it's time to actually do more. And you are doing it in certain cases for Ukraine. And this sort of hypocrisy and double standard is actually clearly destroying the international legal framework as we know it today. So, for God's sakes, please stop doing that. And for Muslim countries to step up and follow pursuit, because this is our region. The Arab countries need to come together and realize that just like regionally EU is dealing with the Ukrainian issue, the Arab countries need to come together more solidly and give a quiet response that we're not going to do business with Israel. Even those who have signed Abrahamic Accords, pull back their ambassadors and those agreements until we get some serious feedback. So there are things that practically can happen and will do if they have the backbone to do that. That's the big one.
Yeah, that's the big question. But Batul, I mean, Sheikh Naim Qassem has reiterated that Hezbollah defends and will persevere and stand firm. And surrender, he says, leaves nothing. Resistance opened the path to possibilities. I mean, your thoughts on these statements, and in general, your overall prognosis of what lies ahead for the Lebanese resistance, and in general, Lebanon right now, with a very, very volatile situation right now. Your thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. Essentially, what Sheikh Naim over here is saying is that the resistance presence should really be considered for the government a source of strength, and needs to be added to this will of the government that seeks sovereignty and stability. So effectively, where there is a vacuum, and let's be real, the Lebanese government is unable to deter Israeli aggression because the Lebanese government is unable to arm itself in a way where it can defend its sovereignty because America, it controls the dictates and it does not allow. So suppose tomorrow the Lebanese government was to take hold of the resistance weapons, we will see a similar situation as of Syria, and that is the Israeli occupation entity will rain down its explosions across those weapons depots. So basically, Lebanon, under the American terms of dictates, is not allowed to be sovereign, and this is where the resistance comes in, and it basically fills the gaps. Because diplomacy, as we see it right now, is not being used as a tool for liberation, as it should be. That is a tool to realize Lebanon's sovereignty. Rather, diplomacy is being used to blackmail the Lebanese state to give up the resistance arms and strip it of its sovereignty. So what the resistance is trying to do is to prevent the government from giving up its core interests of sovereignty, as it claims that that is an interest, and really to join it so that it can be a supporting front in fighting this Israeli aggressionist. We know Israel didn't dare to enter Lebanon for the past 24 years, except in 2006, in which it got a heavy bashing. So resistance is necessary. And ultimately, the situation that we see in Lebanon, as far as the supportive, nurturing environment of the resistance, is that never in any time has it ever been as determined and steadfast in its commitment to the path of resistance as it is today. You have the residents of the destroyed borders who, as we speak, are literally living in caravans instead of homes because they cannot afford to rebuild and the reconstruction is not underway. But despite everything, their movement and life has not stopped. They continue to revive their areas, to harvest their crops, to cling to their lands. This kind of steadfastness and attachment to the land, this deep sense of belonging, would not exist without their commitment to the cause and adherence to the path.
Okay.
So those who live among them can sense how deeply they are connected to their land and understand the concept of resistance and how that has transformed into a way of life. And I believe that is the biggest fear for the Israeli occupation entity and America. It's
all
not
right,
the
stay with me,
Batu,
because I only have one
resist.
Minute. So sorry, Sedmoaz, 1 minute. I mean, your overall thoughts about where are we headed in the region with the Israeli aggression and assassinations and destruction continuing. We look at Palestine, we look at Lebanon, the region. Your thoughts?
I mean, you know, just in a nutshell, Israeli Zionist project, it's not checked. And, you know, and these Europeans who are complaining about mass migration and now looking to alternative solutions and safe third countries, well, guess what? There's going to be millions of Palestinians on your door, millions of Syrians, millions of Lebanese. If you keep staying on the back foot, you need to step up and be able to do the same actions you're so-called doing in this conflict with Ukraine and Russia on Israel to get some serious action. And Muslim countries, you have an obligation as fellow Muslims. I mean, that in itself is enough to do something in which to reject these Abrahamic Accords.
Okay.
And those who have signed off to step out from it. That's when you can put true pressure on Israel. Otherwise, they're just going to run over the whole region, Lebanon today and tomorrow somewhere else.
And on that note, thank you both for being with me. Sedmoaz Shah, international law expert, geopolitical analyst out of Geneva, Batu Sobeiti, activist and political analyst out of London. Thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdu wa thana' lillah rabbil alameen wa salatu wa salam ala ashraf al-anbiya' wal-mursaleen habib qulubana wa tabib nufusana abil qasim al-mustafa muhammad wa ala al-baytih al-tayyibin al-tahirin al-ma'asumin al-mukarramin. Respected brothers and sisters, please accept my warmest salams. We are focusing on the 20th dua of As-Sahifa As-Sajjadiyah. And in this dua, which is titled, it's Imam Sajjad's supplication on noble moral traits and acts pleasing to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Imam starts off in the very first phrase of the dua with asking for the most perfect faith, the most excellent certainty. And then he goes to a part that is the topic of our discussion today. this session, and that is the importance of intentions, right? Imam says, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alih, oh Allah bless Muhammad and his household, wa balligh bi imani akmal al iman, and cause my faith to reach the most perfect faith, waj'al yaqini afdal al yaqin, make my certainty the most excellent certainty, and this is the part that we want to focus on, wantahi bi niyyati ila ahsanin niyyat, take my intention to the best of intentions, wa bi amali ila ahsanil a'mal, and my works, my deeds, to the best of works, to the finest ones. Niyya, intention, is very important, and it consists of aim, resolve, determination, and the desire that a person actualizes in the heart and the depth of their soul for carrying out an action or the deed. So intention is very important. Sometimes we do something that is really good, it looks to be very fine, but in reality the spirit of that action, which is intention, is wrecked, it's corrupted. That is not something we want, right? Therefore, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, in the very beginning of this phrase, says that, Ya Allah, give me good intentions. Make my intentions, elevate my intentions to be great ones, to be good ones, to be the best of the intentions. Let's take another break, inshallah. We'll be back quickly.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
A bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Respected brothers and sisters, the value of intention in Islam is so crucial, it's so precious, that a person's deeds are evaluated before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala based on the intentions, based on it, right? A good intention, niyatul khair, has a 100% divine value, and this value transfers to the deeds as well. Sometimes to the extent that we have niyatul mu'min khairun min amalih, the intention of a believer is better than his deed. The intention of a believer is better than the deeds itself, to the extent that sometimes you intend, for example, to do something good, but you never get the ability to do it. You get rewarded for that intention, for that attempt. You make an attempt to do something good, you will not be able to successfully carry it out. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala rewards you for the intention that you had, even though no action was recorded, right, in your letter of deeds. But it's still, that intention is there. Intention is so important, to the extent that we say a bad intention at the same time, niyat su' possesses a satanic coloring, and this hateful coloring affects the deed as well. You might do something else, right? Something that looks really good. I might distribute food to the poor, right? I might perform and carry out an act of charity, but my intention is to show off. My intention is to elevate to my personal credit and my personal value in the eyes of the people, right? That action is not accepted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It adds to the darkness of the heart. The reward for the intention alone, right? A good intention is so important that it is the owner of this intention. If it is, again, unsuccessful in actually performing the deed, they still receive the reward and thawab of the hereafter, just as if they had performed the action based on that intention. And a bad intention, again, is so contemptible and worthless, that an action based on it has no reward or recompense whatsoever. Rather, the bad intention itself can make you face trials and tribulations and persecution in the life of this dunya. There's a hadith from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi. He says, Jabir ibn Abdullah narrates that he heard the Messenger of God say, Rajulan fil ajri sawa'un. There are two men, there are two individuals that are equal in reward. Think about it. We'll take a break And inshallah, we'll come back to tell you the rest of the hadith.
You are listening to the program Bridge on Iran Radio.
All right, respected brothers and sisters, you're talking about the hadith of the Holy Prophet that he said there are two individuals, two separate individuals that will get the same reward, that are equal in thawab and reward. A Muslim man whom God has granted wealth and he spends it in obedience to God, and a poor man who says, oh God, right? رَجُلٌ مُسْلِمٌ أَعْطَاهُ اللَّهُ مَالًا يَعْمَلُ فِيهِ بِطَاعَةِ اللَّهِ وَرَجُلٌ فَقِيرٌ يَقُولُ اللَّهُمَّ لَوْ شِئْتَ رَزَقْتَنِي مَا رَزَقْتَ أَخِي فَعْمَلْ فِيهِ بِطَاعَتِكَ. The poor one who says, oh God, if you wish to provide me with what you provided my brother, I would also spend it. I would also use it in obedience of you. The Holy Prophet says these two people are rewarded the same. They're equal in the level of reward they receive, the thawab. The difference is one has actually spent out of his pocket because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has provided him. The other one just wishes that he had so much money to be carrying out acts of charity, to be spending the money that he has, the possessions that he has from the life of this dunya in obedience of the Holy Prophet. In fact, intention, we should say, is the most important element and component of actions. In fact, we should say intention is so important that causes an action and a deed to be whether accepted or not accepted. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala grant us the best of intentions. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bridge on Iran Radio with Sheikh Mahdi.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را، هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را.
This week on the Moscow Report is one of the most important interviews I've done on this show. It's with the highly respected German journalist Hüseyin Doğru, who for the last couple of years has focused his work on the horrors that we've seen in Gaza and of pro-Palestine protests in Europe. For his work, the European Union some time ago decided to sanction him. It's the first case of its kind, effectively taking away some of the most basic human rights of one of their own citizens due to their journalistic work. Interestingly, the apparatus they've used to take away his rights are the anti-Russia sanctions, even though there's no evidence that he has any links to Russia. He has had some support from important European luminaries like the MEP Claire Daly and the former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis, who see his case as fundamental to the future of human rights and free expression in Europe. And I do believe that it is important for journalists inside and outside the mainstream to stand up for his case and not let it to stand. Hüseyin, thank you so much for joining me. Now, first of all, what is your situation? You've been sanctioned by the European Union. Your bank account's been frozen. There's a travel ban. What is that like, first of all? How has it impinged on your rights and your ability to work and live?
So, thank you for having me here and giving me the opportunity to talk about my case. Being sanctioned as a European citizen within Europe is being in a open prison. You're stripped of all your rights. You're not allowed to work. You're not allowed to earn any income to support your family. You're not allowed to leave the country which you live in or even freely move as a European citizen within Europe. And I think the most hard or more extreme part of that is that my family is suffering from that, even though they have nothing to do with that, because the situation which I'm in, financial situation, but also legal situation, affects them as well. Right now, the situation with me is that nobody can assess, not even the German government, which is responsible for executing the sanctions on me, because I'm in Germany. Even they don't know what the legal status of me is, because sanctions are designed for foreign people living not in Europe, but I'm living in Europe, so it is a black hole right now for all of us, for my family, for me, and for my children.
To sum up your case, first of all, I mean, you're a German journalist, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the last couple of years you've mainly been focused on the horrors that we've seen in Gaza and covering protests in Germany against what is happening in Gaza. But you seem to have been sanctioned under anti-Russia sanctions. That seems very strange. Explain that.
To be able to understand that, I think we need to remember that Germany is not theoretically but practically in war. State of mind is in a war situation and actively supporting a war in the Middle East, which is the genocide against the Palestinians. So if a country is in a war, it is fighting a designated enemy outside of its country, but also inside of its country itself, which is its own population, which are the critical journalists, which are people like me, who are highlighting the crimes that our government here commits. By violating international law, by supporting a genocide, supporting politicians who have international arrest warrants. And if you do so, then that government, which is fighting effectively two front wars, is trying to suppress every single critical voice within its own borders to shut down any opposition. And to be able to do that, they labeled me as a Russian disinformation secret operative here in Germany, because their legal argumentation is, by highlighting the situation of Palestinians in Gaza who are suffering a genocide, by interviewing Palestinian resistance factions like Hamas, like PFLP, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, I would contribute to the disinformation campaign of Russia.
I saw Claire Daly, the famous Irish MEP, talking about your case in Parliament, and as she said, it seems that pro-Palestinian activism in Europe is seen, as you say, as a Russian destabilization campaign. I mean, I think it's more likely the horrors of the slaughter of children that the Europeans are seeing on their TV screens is why Europeans are taking to the streets. But they seem to suggest with your case that it's somehow Russian destabilization.
That goes far back about what happened within Europe since 2012-2015, when the whole conflict around in and outside of Ukraine happened. The European Union put some laws into place which enabled the German government to do all of these things. What they technically did is the European Union militarized information, militarized journalism, which are not aligned with their core narratives, which they openly say so. Maybe you heard of the DSA Act, Digital Service Act of the European Union, which started around 2018, which said disinformation is undermining the European project, questioning the democratic legitimacy. And by saying so, they started to target journalists here, which are not or questioning the politics of the European Union. And that turned into like a repression machine here in Europe, which is used especially since 2015-16 with the Russia label, because as you know as well from your journalism, governments push illegal or authoritarian laws when there is a kind of fear within the society. And German society, or European society, is in a fear created by the European Union that Russia is going to attack us, or Hamas operatives are within European borders, will do terrorist attacks. And these.
Because what is your, just ask you, what is your views on Russia? I saw an article you wrote recently in which you referred to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which isn't the words that the Russian government or Russian media would use about what is happening in Ukraine. I know you're critical of the militarism that's happening in NATO, but you don't seem to have been campaigning very much, too much. You've been focused on other issues. You don't seem to be pushing Russian disinformation very much.
No, I mean, my view on Russia, which I expressed on several occasions and also in my work as well, is I see Russia like I do see European countries, as well as two sides of imperialist blocs who are fighting for political capital interests right now in Ukraine. That was always my view. This is always what I critique.
And so you've been sanctioned for essentially under this Russian sanction regime, but have they given you any evidence that you are linked to Russia?
If you look at the sanction paper, which is public, it says, as you also mentioned at the beginning, sanctioned in context of the 17 Russia sanctions. Then the explanation in that paper is by news coverage on primarily pro-Palestinian protests, the crackdown on pro-Palestinian protests here, covering a university occupation, which was for them apparently dangerous to cover that, and covering violent protests within the European Union. That was categorized as creating discord and destabilizing or threatening the unity of the European Union. But later, we got the evidence pack of the European Union, which was something completely else, which is critical opinions, my private opinions, but also as Red Media, my media outlet back then, about the German politics, about historical facts that we publish. One example, and this is a historical fact, that former SS Nazis, SS commanders, SA commanders from Hitler fascism after the Second World War became commanders or generals within NATO and had very high ranking positions. The European Union categorized that as wrong and disinformation, or a critique of me that German journalists do not cover the repression against me was categorized as disinformation and used to sanction me as well. So So it's two different layers, three different. It's accusing of being Russian, explaining with Palestine, but the evidence indicates that the German government was not happy about my reporting and critique with their politics.
And so they've just tried to find, in intelligence speak, it's called throwing spaghetti at a wall. It seems that they're, see whatever sticks. It seems that they're just trying to push anything on you, but without any real evidence.
No, there is no real evidence. Technically, what they present as evidence is disinformation itself and historical revisionism. I think it was McNamara, the European MEP, who said, by fighting disinformation, we are becoming exactly what we are fighting against. And this is today happening. And I think Europe is not doing a mistake, is not a glitch in the matrix, or it is not a stupidity of certain political. I think it's a political line today that information needs to be controlled, critical voices need to be shut down, oppressed, even if it's journalists now today. Step by step, the liberal bourgeois democracy that we know needs to be dismantled by those who are upholding that, because today it is a barrier, it is an obstacle for them to push their militaristic agenda, their Rearm Europe project, and the entire shift to the right within Europe as well. And the only barrier for that is their liberal democracy, and now it needs to step by step demolished. This is what is happening in Europe.
So I want to ask you something very important, perhaps the most important question today. I've seen you actually sent me a document by a former European court judge. It's a recent document in which basically they make clear that the sanctions regime, particularly against you, because you're a German citizen, you're not Russian, is actually against European law. Now, I've read the document, it's all in legal speak, but it makes clear basically what anybody, even without a legal background, should intuitively be able to understand, that taking away a citizen's rights without any due process is quite clearly not only against European law, but against the founding basis of European civilization.
Yes, the report mentions several elements here. First is that the European Union, by sanctioning a European citizen, stripped off all of his rights, which he or she has within the European Union, which is freedom of movement, freedom of expression, and the right to technically survive, to be able to work. So these rights are stripped off. I'm not allowed to exist. Just to make it maybe more concrete, people think about sanctions, assets are frozen, as I would have like millions now in my account, then I would definitely not be here. And you're not allowed to travel, but it goes further technically. So what is happening with me specifically is that the right of existence is gone. The right as a European citizen is gone, as Yanis Varoufakis mentioned as well. You're non-person anymore. And I think that is the punishment itself. And if you go also further and read in this report, it also says, and for that you need to understand sanctions. Sanctions, like the European Union describes it, about to bring a change in your behavior. And later they say it is not about non-illegal behavior. It is about non-illegal illegal behavior that we want to change. So you don't need to do anything wrong.
So if you think, if you suddenly gave up your work, if you announced on X or whatever, you know, your social platforms, that I am giving up my work, my journalistic work, do you think they'd just take the sanctions off? I think they would.
I don't think they would. Like, first of all, I would not do it because I did nothing wrong. I used my rights, which they are supposed to uphold, first of all. Second, I do not think they will reverse the sanctions, because the sanctions itself is illegal, because there is no disinformation, there is no wrong information, there is no support for the Russian government at its war in Ukraine, or whatsoever. I mean, the legal report highlights that as well, that The problem is not the person, the problem is the mechanism that the European Union created, that now a certain intent, a certain different opinion can be now punished without judicial control. That's also what they critique. It is an extrajudicial process.
Because if your case is allowed to stand, if what's happening to you is allowed to stand, essentially now the European Union can strip citizens of their rights for essentially putting across ideas that they don't like. In fact, on any subject, I mean, you've hardly even spoken about Ukraine. You've, like millions of European people, you've been angry and through your journalism advocating, if you like, for Palestinians or right to protest over Palestinians, and that's essentially why you've been sanctioned. So if your case is allowed to stand, it essentially means the European Union can strip anybody of their rights without any due process.
Exactly, like my case right now is a precedent case. If, as my lawyer said, you're holding the Pandora's box closed, and if you leave that now, that Pandora's box is opened, and it's doomsday in Europe. And we can feel that this fear is working in Germany, because there is extreme self-censorship of journalists, of politicians, and activists. They're not talking about it. Personally, they talk with me. It's so horrible with you what happened, but it's too hot for me.
Because
and this is the aim. The process itself is the aim.
And is that one of the reasons they went after you? Because I have the same experience as you. You know, obviously, the last few years I've been known for my criticism over NATO policy over Ukraine, but I speak to mainstream journalists privately. They say very different things than they do publicly. But is that one of the reasons you think they've gone for you? Because if you silence one journalist, if you kill one journalist, you silence hundreds or thousands more. And is that? Do you think what's happened to you has had a chilling effect on German journalism?
Yeah, what happened to me has a chilling, has a extreme dangerous effect, not on the journalists, but on the entire society and the political spectrum as well. It is something that is legalized by the European Union that gives all the possibilities to do that. So the government itself can execute all of that by referring to the European Union. A, impunity, that we, the German government says, we did not do that as a European Union. And therefore it becomes like legitimized for them. And they will, they're extending these more repressions more and more. And that has a chilling effect. That has an effect of fear. That has an effect of what the liberal journalists describe happening in Iran, happening in China, happening in Venezuela, these authoritarian regimes. But this is even far worse here. For example, I'm someone with a Kurdish background. I know all the political experiences and the repression in Turkey as well. In Turkey, they do it, the repression, without having a legal ground. Here in Europe, which is more dangerous, they have a legal ground now. They can refer to the rights, to the regulations of the European Union, and to emergency situations that they create themselves, and have a legal base for it. And this is, I think, the most dangerous, and it will attack in the future. Working class people who want to strike, journalists who want to write, musicians who want to perform arts, which the government does not like anymore.
And so there are increasingly other cases in Germany, the UK, Europe. I don't know whether you know that George Galloway, I'm sure you know who he is, very recently has gone into exile because he was detained as he got off a plane in London. There are other cases, my own case. do you feel, and these seem to be, it's difficult to know whether criticizing Israel or criticizing NATO policies on Ukraine is worse. But do you fear that with your journalistic colleagues and around Europe that there is increasing authoritarianism and a fear of extreme repercussions for speaking out?
Yes, we can feel that everywhere. If you, as a journalist, have no trade union backing you up, in contrary, being part of that repression, if you have mainstream journalists who are becoming now the mouthpiece of the governments here by starting disinformation campaigns. I mean, we saw the best example, but it was with me here in Germany. My sanctions are technically the result of the disinformation campaign of mainstream journalists here. Or we saw it when Jeremy Corbyn a couple of years was attacked by mainstream media for being anti-Semitic. We saw the whole atmosphere created by the 10% of media outlets that we are in a, there is an imminent threat for us, that Russia or someone else will attack us. That creates that authoritarianism, that this is part of the authoritarianism, because governments use media to enforce or control information. And that's the dangerous side. Like, the information that I gave is not wrong. Like, the best example, I interviewed Hamas representatives. That was categorized by the European Union and today by the German government as giving terrorist organizations a platform. The very same Hamas politician was interviewed by German mainstream media. That was okay. So that shows me it is not about if the information is right or wrong. It's about having the monopoly on information to influence the society. This is what they're afraid of, especially when you have journalists like you or journalists like in England that we saw from Electronic Intifada, S.A. Winston, I think it was, whose house was raided. And across the board, Richard Medhurst, for example, is about if you have these little cases of journalists which you can't control, then you need to suppress them with all the means necessary. And it is, in the past, it was only the police, military, or the government itself, but they have now found a better tool, which is their own, which I call now state-funded independent journalists, or the foot soldiers of their politics today.
Because it seems crazy that this is one of my major points, that suppressing these journalists, and I know most of the people you've just mentioned, I'm sure you do as well, that there's some outstanding journalists out there who are all too often just correct in their work. Those who criticized Israel at the start of what happened in Gaza suddenly become more mainstream, the realization that what Israel is doing actually is not also not in Western interests. And indeed, for example, my work on Ukraine, I warned the West or NATO that they would fail in Ukraine, the counteroffensive would be a failure. And now you said that there should be peace. That is changing. It seems that closing down journalists have they perform a civil duty. And the idea that Germany shouldn't be blindly supporting Israel, the idea that Germany or the European Union should not be blindly supporting Ukraine, it's very easy to make that case, that it's in European interests not to do these things. And it's journalists like yourself who are stating that. So to silence them and shut them down, in my view, is simply not in German or European interests. It's damaging European interests by silencing someone like you.
I agree. I think it is not about European interests anymore. It's about the interest of certain capitalist interests. It's about the interests of certain military-industrial complex. It's for lobby organizations. If you look today, especially Germany praises have never again, never again, never again. If they mean never again, it means also for the most oppressed people right now in Germany, which are the Muslims, which are the migrants, which are people of color, which are Palestinians especially. I think this rhetoric, never again, upholding democracy, is used to push certain political interests. I don't believe that Germany, for example, is supporting Israel because of the historical guilt. That is non-existent today, because before October 7, there was a sharp rise of anti-Semitic attacks by the far right here, but we don't talk about that. I think Gaza is a good, or October 7, the prison break of October 7 was a good opportunity to push their interest, to regain interest again in the Middle East, which they lost. I mean, pre-October 7, the influence of the West in the Middle East was almost non-existent, except the US. Now they have the opportunity to go in, now they have to push, or they can push certain political and military interests as well. I mean, we know that the whole thing that happened in Syria, it was not about Assad or not Assad. We know that the attacks on Iran is not about to bring back democracy in Iran. It's about step by step opening up the way towards China as well, to the bigger threat, economical, political, cultural threat. I think these are little elements that they use today to go for a long strategic political militaristic plan, and that you can see being reflected in the European politics. Rearm Europe. Germany wants to spend $500 billion into military. Everyone needs to spend more for militarization. But those who talk about unemployment yet, about housing, about economical crisis. They're being shut down. And these journalists, it's been you, it's been me, and it's been others as well. So we should not talk about the misery that this system here created, but we should look at the supposed threats that come from Asia and Middle East. Is a distraction for me. Yes, we have problems around the world, obviously, but we need to start here. We need to start fixing things in these countries before we bomb other countries like it is a European tradition to do so.
And so what do you plan to do now? I mean, I know you've had some quite important support from some European MEPs, Yanis Varoufakis, the famous former German economy minister. You have got some...
Greek economic minister.
Greek, what did I say? German, I'm so sorry. Greek economist, economic minister. So you do have, I mean, you're a very respected journalist. You do have some support. But what do you plan to do now? I mean, is it difficult living now? You're carrying on your work as you can. But what do you plan to do? Do you want to take this to court? How are you going forward in this?
Right now, we submitted our case to the European Court of Justice, which will now review our case and then decide at some point if there will be a hearing or not. Sometimes the European Court of Justice decides without a hearing yet it was wrong or right, etc., etc. But before submitting our case to the European Court of Justice, we asked, because that's the process. You need to ask the European Commission to rethink the sanctions three times, and they said no, it's legit. We did no mistakes, as the German Foreign Ministry spokesperson said. Germany does no mistakes. They literally responded to the journalist's question about me. Say no, we don't do mistakes. So we are waiting. That can take 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, 4 years. We don't know. But there is a danger in that, as former European Court of Justice judge wrote in her report. Every 6 months, sanctions are reviewed. It sounds very good, but it's a danger because, again, there is a mechanism there. Every 6 months, they could sanction it again for another reason. While I'm fighting that, then another case opens up. So I could be in a limbo for years and years, maybe a decade. We don't know.
Especially as you're carrying on your work. So you don't know, you could say something or do something, they decide, well, we don't like that either.
Exactly. Like, just me complaining about that, that my case is not covered in the media, was a reason to keep my sanctions. That was officially used as a reason, because that was disinformation for them. I'm still working, but I think all the newspapers were in solidarity with me. They're kind of happy because they don't have to pay me, because they can't pay me right now. It's forbidden. It's, you can be charged up to 5 years, I think, for that, going to prison. But I need to work because it is important, especially during times when the oppression is the highest, to inform people about that so it does not happen again. And this is my understanding, never again is now, by standing up against that.
Because I think your case really is a deeply important case for the future of Europe. If it's allowed to carry on what's happening to you, then it will happen to other people. Do you fear for the future of freedom of speech in Europe?
I think the future is already now. I do fear. It is dangerous. It reminds a little bit of the dark times in Europe in the 30s. It reminds, and there are parallels to that. I don't say it's the same, obviously not, but parallels do happen. I think it was before Hitler took power, or short after that, don't nail me on the ear, like 36, 7, 38, there was a law brought up by the Nazis called Schriftleitergesetz, which meant that newspapers or the editors-in-chief needed to report on benefit, like in line with the governmental interest. Otherwise, they could be arrested, prosecuted, or killed. Today, they don't kill you, literally, but the EU says. And that's the whole definition of sanctions as well, which is quite creepy. sanctions are designed to change your legal behavior with a view to promoting the objectives of the European Union and its foreign security policy. Like, it is the same, if you want to be very...
What shocks me about this is that European policy, foreign policy, is clearly doing huge damage to the European, to European states and the European people. If you look at their policy on Russia and Ukraine, even if the most pro-Ukrainian supporter would admit that European policy has been a disaster, it's caused huge damage to European industries. And so now you've got to this cycle, this damaging cycle, where you can't criticize European policy, even though European policy is wrong and it's damaging European interests.
I think it is a design cycle. Again, I will do historical comparisons here. What is happening today, because you mentioned a couple of times that what is happening today, or what European Union does today, is technically damaging the European economy, the European society, and you're right. And that happened also before Hitler took power back then. And Europe was, or Germany was, in an economical crisis. Its car industry, its industry, manufacturers, it was all in a crisis. And then Hitler came, took power, or they gave him this power. And he changed the whole industry into a militaristic industry. And this is what we're seeing today. We see, I mean, if you look at the statistics of the German government and the news about from the last 2 years, the car industry, which was the heart of Germany, is collapsing. It is compared to others around the world. And now they need to change that industry into something that is bringing you profits. And what brings you more profits than war? Because if you're in an active war, you need to buy weapons. Look at Germany's Rheinmetall. It was, their stock price were before the war in Ukraine on the bottom. Now it's skyrocketed. You can't even buy, I don't know if you are into stocks, but you can't even buy that now. They're billionaires, trillionaires today. And if you look who is benefiting from that crisis, I think things get very obvious. It's not the people in Europe, it's not the people in Russia, China, or whatsoever. It is these companies, it is these military-industrial complexes that benefit from it. That's why they want and need the war.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio broadcast from Tehran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. In Islam, the ink of the scholar is more holy than the blood of the martyr. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5% of the world's population. Due to the birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest growing religion in the world today. We start off this hour's programs with A to Z of Life. This program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran, as well as inspirational poetry and stories. Next up will be our radio productions feature. They will be followed by The Key, The program presents short answers to doubts and ambiguities raised about various Islamic and Shiite topics. Our varied radio productions feature will round up this hour's programs. Stay with us for this hour.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to get fit. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to 8:30 on I'm Being Shredder with me, Sister Zainab, and obviously the keeping fit. Now, this is a topic that I think is hugely under-addressed, and it's actually hugely important. And look, before I go into detail there, look, the reason is that, yeah, I think many of us forget that one of the greatest blessings we're given, in a sense, apart from youth, and obviously we're told that, you know, it's one of the things that we don't really value youth until we've lost youth. And then obviously one of the other, and one other thing that we probably don't value enough until we've lost it, and that is good health. And many of us, a majority of us, are born with decent, with good health. And then, you know, as we grow up, as we become young adults, we just sort of take it for granted for quite a long time, I suspect, because, hey, we're still feeling healthy. In our 20s and 30s, we feel healthy. But then maybe when people start, you know, they have their families, their kids are maybe sort of still young or even teenagers, and then they realize that, hey, where's the energy gone? And look, everything that Allah gives us, so whether it's our mind, whether it's particular talents we're given, and some people, for example, have talents with languages, some people have talents with their hands, some people are so talented that they can become their country's top mathematicians, top scientists. You know, all of us have special skills and talents that Allah gave us, and that we, inshallah, we're all nurturing and developing further. But, you know, health is also one of them. We cannot neglect it. And I tend to always myself say, well, you know, we're meant to be servants of Allah. And, you know, obviously Allah wants us, and we can't really serve. Allah needs nothing from us, so we should be serving here in this temporary life, this temporary world. So we should serve our community, we should serve other people, we can serve nature, we can serve environment, contribute there. And there's one very vital aspect to be able to be a good servant. Welcome back to Aid here, and I'm Being Shared with me, Sister Zainab. And so obviously I've just mentioned there's one vital aspect to being a good servant of Allah, and that is having good health is actually very vital and very useful. Because obviously you can imagine for yourself that if you don't take care of your health, your lifespan is going to be shortened. Now, just from the point of view of being a good servant of Allah, obviously that means you cannot be a good servant of Allah for quite as long. And in a sense, I would even add in that if you're not looking after your health, often on the contrary, you have habits that are harmful, that common knowledge and common sense nowadays would say it's harmful for health. And may I say, yes, I will mention things such as smoking. We all know, none of us can escape the knowledge that smoking is okay, I'm fine, I'm healthy. No, we know. Doctors, medicine, science confirms it nowadays. It's not good for us. So A, it's going to cut short our life and make part of our life more difficult because we might get very ill because of it. And, you know, secondly, to actually do that to ourselves, to harm ourselves, surely that is a very bad thing. Allah, it would not really, we don't really have the right to damage ourselves knowingly because everything is given to us by Allah.